I speak to you this morning in the name of God, Mother and Father, Incarnate Word, and life-giving Spirit. Amen. Have you ever wondered what your life would be like if you knew you were going to live forever? If you had not just a sure and certain hope of the resurrection, of living forever, but an actual solid guarantee. How would that change your life? What would you do differently, if anything? I ask because I know from experience that we live our lives and make our decisions and our choices in the context of certain powerful emotions: fear, anxiety, hurt, and hopelessness. They aren't the only feelings we experience, thank goodness, but they cast a long shadow. And the longest shadow, of course, is cast by the fear of death. At the root of all our fears and all our anxieties is the approach of sister death. But if we knew we were going to live forever, we would in all likelihood stop worrying, or at least stop worrying as much as we do. We would be much more firmly grounded in the present moment, in the here and now of life as it comes to us. We would enjoy the permission to risk and make mistakes because we would have a long time to repair them. And the stories of our pasts would not haunt us so much with their hurts and regrets. And our future? Well, our future would cease being a minefield of danger and fears and would become instead luminous, beckoning dawns of promise. But perhaps it would have its downside too. Perhaps we would be a lot lazier, less sensitive, maybe even less kind if we knew we were going to live forever. I might be late more often for appointments. I might preach much longer homilies. And our meetings might become interminable. So there is something to be said about knowing that there will be a definite end, and maybe even that the end is near. Knowing that we don't have all the time in the world. Recently, I heard one acquaintance say or ask another acquaintance, "What's up? How come you're suddenly giving all this money to charity and volunteering all over the place? When did you become such a do-gooder?" And the second acquaintance said, "When I woke up and realized I needed to cram for the final exam." So here's an equally searching question. What would you do differently? How would you live your life if you knew you were going to die tomorrow, Monday? According to an apocryphal story that I like, Martin Luther was once asked that question, to which he responded, "If I knew I was going to die tomorrow, I would plant a tree." Which I think is a lovely response because it reveals Luther's deep and abiding faith in God's constant and eternal love for him and for all of creation, And it reveals Luther's love for the neighbors who will come after him. Now, contrast Luther with the rich man in today's parable. Instead of having a deep trust in God's love and provision for him, the rich man is desperately anxious and insecure. Materially, he's done very, very well. His skill and his enterprise and his foresight have made him a vast fortune. In fact, he's overwhelmed by the abundance, and it creates a little bit of a crisis for him. But he comes up with a plan. He builds ever larger barns and storage bins for his burgeoning possessions, safeguarding them prudently for his future. All because he's desperately worried about the what-ifs of human existence. At the root of it is his belief that there is no one to rely on except himself. He is so unafraid and so untrusting, he becomes hyper-focused on his own survival, his own prosperity, his own well-being. And did you notice the narcissistic tone of his inner dialogue? I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods for your many years, so relax, eat, drink, be merry. This man has decided to have a party for one. He lives in a world of one, privileging his own needs and his own desires. It's a world without God, and it's a world without neighbors. Now, just to be clear, having great wealth is not the problem here. It is worshiping his great wealth, which is to say, putting his trust for his future in wealth, to the exclusion of all else. That's the problem. And it's a problem we call idolatry. And it's idolatry because it violates the great commandment of his and our tradition that we should love the Lord our God with all our heart and with all our mind and with all our strength and with all our money, and our neighbor as ourself. And contrast this rich man with another wise and prudent rich man in our tradition, Joseph of Egypt. Joseph, who during 7 fat years of abundance had all the wheat carefully stored into new silos, which he had built, so that when famine came, 7 lean years of famine, he could open up the doors to all who were hungry, to all of his neighbors, those near at hand and those far away, even the neighbors who didn't deserve his mercy and generosity. Remember, like those neighbors who had thrown him into a pit. What Joseph did with his abundance, the rich man couldn't do. So Jesus calls him a fool. He's a fool because he cannot or will not trust in the God who is abundance. He is a fool because he does not notice or recognize abundance incarnate standing right beside him. When he looks at Jesus, he simply sees a useful person who could help him arbitrate an inheritance dispute. He is greedy, believing that his cup is half empty, believing that hoarding for himself is the order of the day, and yet starving all the while. He is greedy because he is so hyper preoccupied with his own needs, which leave him with little or no bandwidth to think about or meet the needs of others, or even more importantly and sadly, to worship the God of justice who yearns for the well-being of all of her children. It's the God who is described by the prophet Hosea as a tender, long-suffering mother who continues to love her children, to search for her children, to desire the best for her children, despite their indifference, their betrayal, their greed. This is a mother who takes us up in her arms, leads us with cords of kindness and bands of love, bends down to feed us. The God who also reveals to us through the prophet her deepest, most painful inner conflict. She is torn between her righteous anger and her frustration and her disappointment with us and her infinite compassion and love, her empathy for our weakness. But did you notice? There is this painful inner conflict, but it is resolved not in favor of wrath or retribution, but in favor of mercy. This is the most useful passage, or one of the most useful passages. Remember it next time you go to a cocktail party or even a Bible study or a coffee hour and someone asserts that false dichotomy between the God, the vengeful, angry, harsh God of the Old Testament and the merciful, loving God of the New Testament. Remind them or suggest to them that they read the prophet Hosea. This is a God who is rich toward her children, rich beyond measure. And when someone is rich toward us, the most natural, the most appropriate response is for us to be rich in return. My friends, like the rich man, we North Americans are blessed by abundance, individually and collectively as a community, as a church here at the corner, rich beyond measure. So what do we do with our abundance? Are our decisions and choices informed by the greed born of insecurity and lack of trust? Or are our decisions and choices informed by a deep and abiding trust in this mother who is always there for us and will always provide for us? The Divine Mother, in whom and with whom we have a covenant of friendship, which means living forever. At this church, on this corner, we have thrown open our doors to share our abundance. And for that, we are all deeply grateful and I think rightly proud. But are they completely open? Are we trusting enough? Are our fears, which can be aroused by strangers in our midst, who may be different from us, does that limit our welcome? Does it modify or dilute it, making it less radical than it could be? Can we truly be open to everyone, including those who are our enemies? Do our fears about the what-ifs of our future prevent us from hearing God's call to change, to do things that are different and risky? Maybe to adopt ways of being and worshiping that entail loss for us, but also herald newness of life. The truth is, we are all going to die tomorrow, and we are all going to live forever. Given this truth, let us ask, how can we open our doors ever wider? Let us ask, when and where can we plant a tree? Let us ask, how can we be rich toward our God? Amen.